This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The United States Senate is often contentious and divisive and these days hyper-partisan, but no matter the current political climate or shift in leadership, the building itself is full of rich American history. And that's true, too, for the actual desk at which senators work while conducting business on the floor. Ohio Democratic U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown sits at desk number 88. And the story goes, each previous occupant over the centuries has chiseled his name inside. Brown celebrated eight of those names in his new book, Desk 88, Eight Progressive Senators Who Changed America. Senator Brown was in Cincinnati late last month, and he joined me in the studio to talk about the book. Senator Sherrod Brown, thanks so much for being with us.
Thrilled to do it. Thank you.
So the name of the book is Desk 88, Eight Progressive Senators Who Changed America. Now, Desk 88 is not just a title. It's an actual thing, an actual historical
idol. Thing.
Yeah, in the chamber. Tell us about why it's important. This is where you sit. Yeah,
the desks are all numbered 1 to 100. The numbers really mean nothing except happens to be the number of mine and number of counties in Ohio, which has nothing to do with each other either. But on freshmen choose last. We choose our offices last, our committees last, and our desks last on the floor. And so there were 10 desks left for the 10 freshmen 12 plus years ago. And there's no bad seats. You're not sitting behind a post at a old baseball stadium. So I'd heard that senators sort of like middle school scratch their names, carve their names in their desk drawers. So I started pulling out desk drawers and I came upon about the fourth one said Black, Alabama, Ribicoff, Connecticut. Then it just said Kennedy, one word, no first name, no state. Ted Kennedy sat about four chairs away. And I said, Ted, come here a second. And he came over and I said, which brother's desk is this? He said, well, it's got to be Bobby's. I have Jack's. So he got first choice, and I was happy with that. So I decided I wanted that desk. It also had George McGovern, whom I actually knew of the eight I wrote about. He's the only one I actually knew. And then I just started thinking about these characters in history. My wife, who is a journalist and loves history as I do, went on eBay and ordered about a dozen books all out of print, all about $3 each that nobody else wanted. And I started reading these. And over time, I read about 160 books about the Senate and about senators and did about 100 interviews and over 10, 11 years wrote this book.
Well, when we think about the desk and those names and to think about those men working at that desk, I mean, what has changed about the desk physically? I mean, is it just the same physical?
Yeah, the desk, the chairs come and go. I mean, senators, when they leave, can actually buy their chairs. The desks are old, and I've not been able to find out exactly how old this desk is, but there was a carver out of, I think, Connecticut that carved 68 of these desks to begin with, and then they're all sort of replicas of that. Some are a little bit different, but the desks are kept in good shape, and they're not. You know, we don't really work at our desk very often except in session. I mean, you don't see senators out there writing bills on the desk, but I think that used to happen before there were the Senate office buildings haven't been there forever. So, and the staffs were smaller, but the desks, all of the things around the Capitol are kept in really good shape. It's the institutions that the nation cares about.
Exactly. And as I was reading your book, you do include, you know, in addition to these eight stories or these eight profiles of these men, you share a lot of little nuggets from history. And one such nugget is this example of Jefferson Davis's desk. And, you know, we remember him as the leader of the Confederacy, right? A traitor to the nation.
A traitor.
Serve.
Yeah. Always important to remember that.
Yeah, he did serve in the Senate. Yeah. And his desk is still there.
His desk is still there. In 1861, after the secession, and Jefferson Davis had left the Senate, the Union Army bivouacked all over the Capitol. And there were one day the Secretary of the Senate walked in, and a Union soldier with his bayonet was trying to cut up the desk, trying to break up his desk. And the Secretary of the Senate stops at what he's doing. He said, well, Jefferson Davis is a traitor. And the Secretary of the Senate said, this is government property of the U.S. government. And so he stopped. They rebuilt the desk, and they have about a 2-square-inch they two square inches they leave of damage to the desk just to show that that's what it was. And the senior senator from Mississippi always sits in that desk. So there are three or four. There's the Webster desk, Daniel Webster desk. There is the majority leader and the minority leader's desk. And there's the Lincoln Day or the Jefferson Davis desk. Every other desk is sort of up for grabs by seniority.
But the candy desk, I read, is also very
important.
The candy
desk is not really one of the 100 desks, but there is a desk where, as I like to say, when Jay Rockefeller was in the Senate, the candy was better, but it's not bad.
The former senator from West Virginia. Yeah, of course. Okay, so these eight men that you profile are Hugo Black, Theodore Francis Green, Glenn Taylor, Herbert Lehman, Al Gore Sr., William Proxmire, Robert F. Kennedy, and George McGovern. Now, some of these names stand out in just general history knowledge more than some of the others. I want to quickly pinpoint on the Kennedy because you very casually mentioned how you asked Ted Kennedy whether it was, you know, Jack or Robert Kennedy's desk that you were getting. And, you know, the idea of serving with the Kennedy, this longstanding American tradition family, is so fascinating. Why does Robert F. Kennedy have a spot in this book for you?
Good question. First of all, I wanted to say, beginning, all eight of these are white men. That was the Senate in those days. I would say that 50 years from now, the next eight senators, or however many, will be some women, some people of color, and probably more progressive, because diversity generally means a more progressive kind of environment and work ethic and work product. Kennedy, I love Bobby Kennedy, and I really like Ted. Ted was, I think, the best. Ted's first 20 years in the Senate were just mediocre. His last 20, he was the best senator, I would say, in American history. Bobby wasn't. Jack wasn't. The Kennedys, all they're interesting, partly because of their journey. Bobby started off working for Joe McCarthy, and then as attorney general for his brother, he wiretapped the president of the United States, he wiretapped Dr. King. And then the last 4 years of his life, and I try to explore sort of why and how he changed, but he became a cult figure and a hero to progressives, and was one of the most empathetic characters in modern political history.
He had a journey that was witnessed in the public, and maybe the type of history that would face tougher scrutiny now if we were to talk about wiretapping a civil rights leader and then becoming a Democratic presidential candidate.
May have never had a chance today with social media and with the spotlight shining brighter. Certainly Hugo Black, the first person I wrote about, would not have been able to do that. He started off in the Klan in 1926 in Alabama. He said afterwards that he renounced the Klan pretty soon after he was elected, but he voted like a Klansman in terms of on lynching and other things. But he said, I would have joined any group that got me votes. And it really is a lesson in opportunism that, you know, young people might be willing to sacrifice their souls to get ahead. And although Black, 30 years after he renounced the Klan, was elected, renounced the Klan. 30 years later, he was burned in effigy at his law school in Alabama by Klansmen because of his leadership and support for Brown v. Board of Education, the first real attack on segregation by the courts.
Well, those journeys from people like Kennedy and certainly the senator from Alabama as well is something I wanted to ask you about, because in this day and age, you are held responsible for actions, policy positions that you took.
Since junior high.
Exactly. Yeah. What impact do you think that has on modern discourse today?
That's a really good question. I think a couple of things. I think you don't, you know, I think Black probably was trying to make up for his Klan membership through his whole career. I think that always, as it should have bothered him. And you know, you don't really forgive it. You want to embrace change. You want to celebrate their change. When it was something like a Klan membership or tapping Dr. King or working for McCarthy, it's a little harder to forgive. And you do wonder, I think that's a really good question, why you do wonder in today's world if voters in media and activists could forgive something so egregious, no matter how you evolved. But this book was in part, I mean, the purpose, the real reason I wrote it, I wanted to show that the power of government can be used for really good things to help people. But I also wanted to show the unevenness of people. There are few, and I mean, everybody's obviously blemished in some way. Some with longer careers. Al Gore Sr. had quite a ride where he had voted against civil rights once with his son, the future vice president, begging him not to. He then went on to oppose the Vietnam War, the only Tennessee House or Senate member in either party. And then he took on Nixon's racist to Supreme Court judges, both of whom were not, neither of whom were confirmed. And it probably cost Gore's election. But I think he was at a point in his life where he said, I'm willing to lose to do the right thing. And that's what I celebrate in this book.
And if you can't tell by that trademark voice, my guest right now is United States Senator Sherrod Brown, the Democrat from Ohio. And we're talking about his new book, Desk 88, Eight Progressive Senators Who Changed America. They all shared Desk 88. And Senator Brown sits at that desk in the chamber today. We've been talking about some of the evolving positions that some of the folks that you profile in this book have experienced. Senator Hugo Black, Senator Al Gore, Senator Robert F. Kennedy, and maybe earlier in their careers, they took some non or unprogressive positions, but then became progressive champions. But even now, there's a lot of debate about what a progressive is. And I'm wondering, in writing this book, how do you define it?
I don't have a simple, clear, short definition, but I look at history this way, that history, Emerson said history is a battle between the conservators and the innovators, conservatives who want to hold onto their privilege and stature and status in life and wealth, and progressives who want to move the country forward. And progressives don't win very often, partly because the deck is some sense stacked towards conservatism. The everything from Fox to talk radio to just the lobbyists and the money and the wealth that they have and the power they have in society. When progressives win, we win really big. We pass collective bargaining. We pass Social Security. We pass safe drinking water and women's rights and civil rights and Medicare and the Equal Opportunities Act, all these kinds of things that stay with us for decades. I mean, America still benefits from the Social Security program and still benefits from Medicare and still benefits from civil rights law. So a progressive is really somebody who's willing to take on the power in society and the wealth of society and the people that don't want to give up any of their power and try to move the country forward.
And you consider yourself a progressive.
Certainly. Absolutely, yes.
And how do you feel in terms of being an heir to this desk as you think about the achievements and the place in history that these gentlemen have for themselves? What does that make you feel like?
It's fun. It's a funny word to choose, but I don't know that all of them would have called, I don't think probably all of them would have called themselves progressives. I'm not sure what, I didn't really find those kinds of self-descriptions. But to me, it's a tradition. I mean, I wear a pin on my lapel. Senators are given pretty nice pins to wear that are pretty expensive, and most of my colleagues wear it. I choose instead to wear this lapel pin given to me at a Workers' Memorial Day rally. It's a depiction of a canary in a birdcage with all the history of the mine workers and the canary in the mines. And it symbolizes to me the role of government. And so I want to add to that progressive tradition from Teddy Roosevelt into, without making myself that big, but Teddy Roosevelt to what Hugo Black did, what Bobby Kennedy did, what Proxmire did, what Glenn Taylor did, and that is standing up on issues of justice and standing up to interest groups that look out for themselves at the expense of a broad society.
I want to talk about Senator Herbert Lehman, who once sat at Desk 88 and is profiled in your book here. Senator Herbert Lehman may not be a household name in that context, but certainly a lot of us recall the name Lehman Brothers, and he was a part of this. And so I found it interesting in reading about his history and some of the policies that he championed in the context that I know, being of this generation of Lehman Brothers and its role in the collapse of the financial markets a decade ago. Talk about him.
Yeah, he's the nephew and son of the two Lehman Brothers, settled in Alabama from German Jews, came to Alabama when German Jews were immigrating to this country the first time, 1830s, 40s, 50s, not sure when. They moved to New York. They were in a dry goods business, then went into finance business. He never was all that interested in it. Herbert wasn't. He was a philanthropist. He ended up being governor of New York. He was lieutenant governor to Roosevelt when he was elected president. He became governor, and he pushed the Little New Deal. While FDR was in Washington with the New Deal that we're all familiar with, he did it probably a little easier than New York Assembly, than the U.S. Congress, to push those kinds of things through. Although even within 10 years earlier, then Lehman took office, there was a big fight in New York on abolishing child labor as late as the 1920s. And major leaders, Columbia University president, the Catholic, many bishops of the Catholic Church supported child labor up until they didn't, and it was abolished. But it just shows how these progressive victories are really big when they happen. They have long-term effects, and how long it takes and how difficult they are.
And really that some people from elite families can take these positions to champion the little guy.
Yeah, yeah, he always did. And, well, the Kennedys, the Roosevelts, I mean, they all were, they all came from wealth. And many, as I think about this, I hadn't thought of that either, that it's really only Lehman and Kennedy that came from great wealth in this book. The others, some struggled, like Glenn Taylor, whom nobody's heard of the eight. I asked about 100 people when I started writing this, and only my brother and two other people knew who he was. I didn't know who he was.
Wow. Well, I realize that you yourself sort of experienced this, I guess, progressive privilege up close and personal. You went to Yale, mm-hmm. And you're just a guy from Ohio, right?
Yep.
But you went to Yale, and it certainly attracts from certain classes. And you cite in this book in 1972 when Richard Nixon had announced another attack on North Vietnam, and students at Yale took to the streets. And so these are students who may identify with progressive politics in some manner, but you specifically target the way that these protesters were berating the police officers, mm-hmm. whom you note are working class mm-hmm. police officers. And you took exception to that. Talk about that.
Yeah, it really bothered me. I was very much against the war. I worked in political campaigns. I had been in a few went with my parents to an anti-war demonstration in Washington. But I was, when Nixon mined the harbors of Haiphong, I was actually campaigning for McGovern in those weeks and trying to get students to come to New Hampshire to knock on doors. And we had some success, but dozens, not hundreds. But when Nixon mined the harbors, students by the hundreds in droves came out of their dorms to protest that and to go down the streets in New Haven, and the cops had set up those wooden horses to say, okay, you can march, but you're not going into the city. You can come to the edge of campus, because they were protecting the property of the downtown business owners. And these are working class people, police officers protecting the property of wealthy New Haven business owners. And these students, many of whom came from great privilege, most of us came from some privilege, were surging down the street. Most of the people that were students within a year or two or three or four would be in law school, med school, or Wall Street or somewhere, all with much more earning capacity than those police officers and their children had. And it just, and then they started calling the police names and off the pigs and all. And it just really struck me, and it really turned my stomach. And I remember this lesson today. I remember how I felt, because I was part of the student group, and then I kind of walked to the side as this was happening, and I just wanted to watch it. And I was, whether they're progressives or not, it was a real class difference that was really disturbing. Maybe the first time in my life I really, really saw that class difference.
Do you see anything similar to that of impacting the success or potential success of left politics today?
Of course, but I also see, I mean, I know that I was talking to a Republican senator from the Midwest, and he's disturbed about Trump in many ways. He doesn't speak out against him, and someday maybe he will. He may vote against him at some point. But he said, my constituents like Trump in part because they think that Democrats look down on them. And then he stopped and he said, but they also I've asked several groups of my constituents, this is a Republican talking about Republican voters. I said, do you think Donald Trump really cares about you? And they said, yeah, he does. But this senator said to me, I know he doesn't. And so it's interesting that progressive that Democrats are seen as in the Midwest are seen as looking down on those people, but Republicans like Trump aren't, and it's puzzling to me.
We've had similar conversations on this very program about whether there's a different standard for Democratic politicians, because Donald Trump lives in a literal gold penthouse in New York City, right? And so he comes from Manhattan, and but the people that would berate someone like you or someone else who's a Democrat would not hold him to that standard.
Yeah, I don't entirely understand it, partly because he attacks the people they don't like, and in the end, that seems to work for him.
All right. I'm talking to United States Senator Sherrod Brown. The name of his book is Desk 88, Eight Progressive Senators Who Changed America. Before you run off, I do want to hear a piece from the book, but I also want to ask you, because you define three progressive eras that have taken place over the course of our history. 1912 was the first one. The era of FDR was the second one. And the 1960s, around the Lyndon Baines Johnson presidency, was another one. And you said that the 2010 possibility of a progressive era was cut short when the Republicans retook control. I'm wondering if you think there's another one on the horizon.
I think there is. There is another one on the horizon. The question is it distant or near? But I think there's a. When I started writing this, I didn't think. Well, when I started writing this, it was in the midst of Obama, and we didn't know. But when I completed it, I didn't think much about that. At least in 2017-18, I do now. I think that there is a reasonably good chance that I think the Democrats are going to beat Trump. I think that there's a reasonably good chance the Democrats win the Senate, and I think we'll know what to do with it. And part of what to do with it, I was talking to somebody in Laconia, New Hampshire, and she works in child care, and she said to me, you know, child care should be a public good. And when you think about, we don't invest in our children in this country, we don't child care work. Child care is too expensive for most couples, and child care workers are paid poverty wages. Something's wrong with that because we don't invest. And I just think we need to look at the world a little more that way. Look at it through the eyes of workers and look at it through the eyes of supporting children better than we do. And I think that can very well lead to a new progressive era, and we'll know what to do with it.
And to that end, I've asked you, and you've agreed kindly to read a piece from your book here.
Sure. Thanks. As the 2020 elections draw near, progressives can never let Trump and conservatives hide behind their language of divisiveness and obfuscation. Dr. William Barber II, a North Carolina civil rights activist, told the New York Times the religious far right hijacked the term evangelicals to make what they are saying sound theological when it really is not. It is clearly Christian nationalist extreme in its views. As my wife, Connie Schultz, noted in her review of Michael D'Antonio and Peter Eisner's The Shadow President, The Truth About Mike Pence, the authors described the religious leader of his party as, quote, the most successful Christian supremacist in American history, unquote. It's pretty simple. Trump and Pence and their enablers in Congress play to fear. They promote a racist, phony populism. They attack people and institutions that their base detests and fears. Fox, The Wall Street Journal, and right-wing talk radio preach a daily gospel of grievance as they marinate in their resentments. They train their listeners and readers to think of themselves as victims. Instead, progressives offer something else, the dignity of work and the dignity of community. We must go everywhere, to metro areas where Democrats do very well, into small towns where Democrats get slaughtered, where the politics is the most difficult. We must show up with our story, America's story, about the dignity of work, about the dignity of community, about our canary.
And that's an excerpt from Desk 88, Eight Progressive Senators Who Changed America. The author is United States Senator Sherrod Brown, and that Democrat from Ohio has been our guest. Senator, thanks so much
for being with us. Thank you so much. Good interview. Thank you.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Elise Meckler. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Subscribe to our podcast at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.